Hello and welcome to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry. Hello,
I'm Emma Bunnell.
You are Hello. Emma Bunnell. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. How
Actually,
are you?
Actually, now that there's another topic we added a last minute to our roster of things to discuss today that's made you far happier than it frankly should, but we'll get to that in a minute. It's been a calm, ordered, sensible start to the Donald Trump presidency. It's all a bit mental over in the US. I don't quite know. So I wrote about the Elon Musk stuff a bit on my newsletter. I'll share the link to that. I wrote about it from the perspective of how people are covering it in the media, which is, I think, missing some of the fundamental points. But there's actual stuff that is actually happening that's really important to discuss. So first of all, there is obviously this Doge, which, can I just reiterate this? Because we're now using the phrase Elon Musk Doge Department, like it's a real thing.
It's not a real thing.
It was completely made up as a troll. It's a named after a silly meme coin. Like, it's a nonsense.
And also, you need to have congressional approval to have a government department, and that's where they get the funding from.
Well,
which is why this doesn't exist, and B, why this thing can't actually abolish government departments.
Well, you've led rather nicely onto the real fundamental here, which is that the theme through any story we could pick is to try and dodge the conventional systems, the conventional accountability processes, and you're right, the traditional and legal funding processes. Like, basically, a lot of this stuff is doing, as far as I can tell, is not within the law.
It's unconstitutional. And in America, that means something legally rather than simply in terms of tradition and process.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it is just barnwood. We've got teenagers running around government departments. We've got, as you say, departments being shut down or threatened with being shut down. On the politics, I want to ask you something. How do you feel the Democrat response has been?
Not great.
Okay.
First of all, it was incredibly quiet. They just kind of went, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to say, which I get. Like, they've just been obliterated in an election. Well, not obliterated. That's a massive overstatement. But they lost an election. They lost the popular vote, which they
haven't. I'm not sure it is a massive overstatement, by the way.
No, they're not obliterated. Obliterated would mean they couldn't come back, and they're not there. Yeah, the popular vote was closer than people are talking about it as. They were very, very quiet. And then they went very noisy, but noisy in a way that just leaned into all of the things that everybody has been saying that they got wrong in their comms for the last, 4 years. So it's like, why are you doing that? Like, there are so many good arguments to support USAID, but going in there and shouting about genocide and you're just sounding like the worst kind of Columbia College student campus activists is insane.
Yes, and yet.
And yet, that is exactly what they've done. I really support what their cause is, but they made me cringe so hard that I was like, I don't want to stand next to you.
And here, the point is, seem to have forgotten. That's what Elon Musk wants. I think they're totally underestimating what their opponents, Elon Musk, Donald Trump, blah, blah, blah. That is the reaction they want. They want their opponents to look cringy. And
absolutely.
Silly and overreactive. And that's had two effects. One, and you've identified both of them, to be honest. One is the kind of the Rahm Emanuels and the establishment Democrats going, oh no, let's pick our fights. We can't win this one. Let's not scream and shout about everything, which leads people like you to quite reasonably say they've been too quiet. And then there's the other types of people screaming and shouting outside government departments, as you say, looking like student protesters.
Yeah, and you are not either of those things. You are the opposition, which gives you a voice and a platform that you need to use strategically and sensibly. And there are ways of doing that that are neither we can't say anything because the American public disagreed with us in November, or we're going to sound like we're on a demo. The official political opposition is not the same as being a protester. And we've got to decouple that.
And equally, you have to understand the constitutional role that Congress has in all of this: money, accountability, appointments. These are all levers that they can really pull. But instead,
Well, I mean, they
to a
could
certain
really
point.
pull if they had. I mean, Donald Trump, and it is Donald Trump, not the Republicans, has a majority in all the houses.
Indeed.
And if you look at what's happened with the appointments, the Republican Party are just completely subservient to Trump and will allow him to do anything. So there is not the ability to do much in either of the houses of Congress
Well,
because
you could stall some of the appointments, couldn't they, the Democrats?
they haven't. No, because they have, it's 50 plus JD Vance. And they, they're getting them over and over and over again.
Yeah, even
Kennedy,
our, yeah.
RFK, Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Hegseth. These are the names that we've thought might not get through. They've sailed through. Well, sailed is
Yeah.
probably a bit strong, but they've got through.
Well, the one Republican that they might have stopped, RFK Jr., just bowed in line,
Just
toed in
completely
line.
caved. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And this is the problem. The Republican Party doesn't really exist anymore. They are the Donald Trump party of Donald Trumpiness. And if Donald Trump decides that he doesn't like you, he will primary you and you will lose your job. And so they all just fall in line.
And that is exactly what we're seeing with the kind of Elon Musk power grab. And I think people have totally underestimated the way the Silicon Valley people think and work, and how they're not used to people saying no, and they're not used to any systems in place that don't allow them to do exactly what they want when they want. And I think we're really seeing that take hold now. I
And
put,
that's incredibly dangerous.
of course it is. The other question, which is not really one for today, but I put it in my newsletter, so I want to throw it out to you, is, I was talking about it in the context of media coverage, but there's the political dynamic to it, which is, Elon Musk is pulling this off in the US, not the kind of guy that's going to stop and say, oh yeah, already flirted with Nigel Farage,
Well, and then rejected him.
but didn't totally reject reform.
No, not at all. He wants Rupert
Lowe,
Lowe.
the former Southampton FC chairman.
I mean, that's why you know, right? Because nobody knows who he is politically.
Well, sure, but I mean, I couldn't name, apart from Richard Tice, I couldn't name any of the other reform MPs. But the point is, he is obviously trying to see how this project can work in different places.
I think that weirdly, the best hope that we have is that Elon Musk and Donald Trump's egos cannot actually exist in the same space for very long,
Which I've assumed will be the
which
case.
everyone assumes will be the case. Yeah.
You
And
say
that
my thoughts are not original.
your thoughts are always original in the way that you express them.
Thank you. But yeah, they're surely going to have a falling out, aren't they? They've got to have a row soon.
I mean, it just, and I think, the whole Elon Musk is president, Donald Trump is just sitting in the chair thing is going to get to Trump
Sure.
eventually. And, we are still very early days. It may not feel like it because so much has already happened, but it is what, less than 3 weeks?
Yeah, January the 20th. We're recording this on February the 7th.
So, we are, there is
We're still
a
able to
long way
count it in
to
days.
go. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's totally insane. The other sort of political dynamic, you mentioned the clash between Trump and Musk, which we all assume will happen. Where's JD Vance in all of this?
Well, that is a very, very good question.
Oh, blimey, thanks.
And a very original one.
Cheers, babe.
Because, I mean, at the moment, Holding is powdered dry because he wants to be the next president, I assume.
Presumably.
And he wants Trump's backing to do that. So he will just bend the knee constantly, so that he can retain the MAGA vote, when the next, round of primaries comes up. But whether he is willing to be that person, whether that person continues to be the presumptive nominee, I think he is at the moment, whether there's somebody else, maybe perhaps named Don Jr.,
Oh,
or
jeez.
Ivanka or Jared waiting in the wings,
Don't
who
even
knows?
joke.
The there is no probably not one singular person vying for that MAGA space. That will be interesting because there was one singular Donald Trump who was always going to take it.
Sure.
And there
And at
will.
this moment, he can't stand for a third term. I know some people have tried to change that.
He can't stand for a third term. He will die eventually. And he is quite possibly going to be a lame duck, certainly after the midterms, which may in part explain why everything's going so fast right now.
Yes. Very fair point. The other big development coming from the US this week was Trump's plan for Gaza.
Oh my God.
I texted you and I meant this sincerely. I sat watching it with, behind my hands. And this is all what I feared with a Donald Trump presidency. I wrote about this for The Spectator. How I'd heard a lot of old Donald Trump will be good for Israel, and I just never bought into that idea. And I tried to step back and be like, just because I don't like Donald Trump, I want to think about it objectively for this other issue. And yet I still couldn't come to the point where what his presidency is a good thing for the end of the war or for Israel moving forward, and indeed the region moving forward. And this week to me just totally prove that. He thinks this is all a real estate deal, this plan.
This
And
whole Riviera of the Middle East thing. I mean, it's quite. There are so many reasons why it's bullshit.
sorry, just to say, let's forget the moral decrepity, if that's a word, of the plan. That I think speaks for itself. We don't need to spend time discussing it. It's fairly obvious how morally repugnant what he's saying is.
I mean, he's basically talking about a land grab for property developers, and for the US to just own this territory so that they can build a bunch of hotels on it. Now, first of all, were I a property developer in the world, looking around for where I want to put my nice, shiny new hotel, one of the things I might consider is insurance costs, for example, and how likely my hotel were to be subjected to some sort of violent insurrection.
Right. She sort of lifted the tone a bit, but I do want to talk about. But because I was horrified in a number of reasons. Now, there is a legitimate point that that area of the world, the Gaza Strip, its centre, the West Bank, and so on, could have been a really prosperous piece of land for the Palestinian people, and indeed should have been. Decades and generations of Palestinian leadership have failed that. I believe that absolutely unequivocally. You can see clips of Bill Clinton talking about deals he offered 25 years ago that could have made the situation better.
I agree. I think it's worth saying that it's not just the Palestinian leadership, but also the Israeli attitudes towards Gaza that
Oh,
have
don't worry,
contributed to
I'm
that.
coming on to Benjamin Netanyahu. Don't worry. But I think as a starting point, you do the Palestinian leadership, we mustn't infantilize them.
No, absolutely. Hamas are awful people and have never had the interests of the ordinary Palestinians at heart.
Well said. But I'm going even back before that, you know, deals offered to Arafat and so on and so on. We don't need to do the history lesson here. But there were ways that you could have had, quote unquote, the Riviera of the Middle East in Gaza. You could have had prosperous Palestinian states. I've said to you before, I say it again, I have always been a two-state solution person. All sorts of things have been rocked since October the 7th, but at a fundamental level, that is still where I am. Obviously, I am. I said we don't need to do the moral repugnancy of this, but I will. You know, you cannot order the forced displacement of people, however, whatever's happened after a war, even if it's a war that, frankly, not they started, that Hamas started. So there's all of that. And so that's why I watched it terribly. And of course, the problem is, you know, I don't hold Israel responsible for Hamas, but, you know, the extremists that have lined up behind Benjamin Netanyahu obviously have not made the situation better, to say the very, very least. And, you know, that I'm happy to say that as well. But I do think there needs to be serious conversations about why Gaza is where it is. But we do have to talk about the day after the war, because please God, it is going to come to an end and hostages will be released and so on and so forth. You know, we know that. Yeah, I could do the whole thing about, oh, yes, there's so much damage because Hamas hides in civilian territory. I think that's true. But you still have to fix stuff that's there.
I do. I think that's true to an extent. I think that the problem, and it's hard for us to conceptualize properly, there is very little of Gaza that isn't civilian territory. There is a problem with putting Hamas fighters in hospitals and schools, yes. Sure. But there is also, you know, we are talking about an UN incredibly buildings. Densely populated
sure, absolutely.
Place where if you have fighters, they will be near buildings.
Sure, which is why it goes back to your point of Hamas not caring about ordinary Gazans, because...
Yes, I mean, again... If you are a sovereign territory, you have the right to have a civilian, an army.
Yeah, but Hamas is not a legitimate army. It's a terrorist organisation.
Hamas is a terrorist organisation, but they are, you know, there are lots of states we would consider illegitimate, undemocratic, that have armies that we don't take that attitude to. I mean, I'm just trying to say that, you know, there are... It's far more complex in terms of the distribution of fighters on the Palestinian side than simply Hamas are putting all of their fighters in civilian areas, because it's all civilian area.
Look, your point about it being densely populated is obviously, like, that's just factually correct. I think your point about Hamas not caring about those civilians is also correct. And I don't think you do. I don't think that's what you were saying. Consider Hamas to be a legitimate organisation.
No, I don't at all. At all. I think that they get strengthened in the same way that the rally around the flag effect, well-known psychological effect, right?
Sure.
Happened in the US after 9/11,
sure.
Happened in the UK after 7/7, all of these things. I think that one of the issues is that Hamas gets strengthened by that rally around the flag effect when Gaza is under attack. And people are like, yes, we need to get rid of Hamas, but first of all, we need to protect Gaza. And I can see why that is an absolutely understandable psychological response to being under attack.
Oh, yeah. I do think that's true I'm sure that's right. That there's this whole debate of, like, does the war strengthen Hamas? Does it radicalise more people within Gaza and so on and so forth? Yeah, I mean, there's a whole different conversation to be had about that, which I think your starting premise is correct. So there's so many different issues going on. The sort of Trump... simplicity to it all.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we'll just send them to Jordan and Egypt. And
it's going
to
be beautiful.
Right. Like, that's just infantile.
It's so infantile. And so it just demonstrates how little he knows of the world, understands or cares about the world beyond the fact that there's some land, I want to build a building. That's that. It really is. It's as simple as a child's drawing.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
The other thing to say, I think there is actually a really strong argument, and again, it's probably been the case for decades, that Arab neighbours such as Jordan, Egypt and so on have not done enough for the Palestinian people. I think there's a really strong case for that. But that doesn't mean you can just say, oh, yeah, go over there.
Absolutely. No, there's a vast amount of difference. And we know this in, for example, conversations about the difference between international aid and taking in refugees. And you know, we should do a bit of both. But you can take in a lot fewer refugees if you invest well in the economies and stability of the countries they're fleeing. And that is the better way round, rather than simply say, well, we're going to clear everybody out of Gaza so that we can put up a load of condos for rich people.
You see, part of me worries, do you think it is like condos for rich people? What rich people are going to go live there?
I don't know. But I think that is certainly what Jared Kushner was talking about a year ago. And that's where this plan was originated, germinated from. Whether any sane rich person, as is going to go there, as I started this conversation on, like imagine the insurance. It will just feel like living in a military compound, because nobody's going to go quietly. Nobody is going to be displaced from this land quietly. Why would they?
None of it makes sense. It's very specific. It feels, frankly, I mean, the whiff of corruption is rife, isn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed.
So I don't quite
know. It's the whiff of corruption, but also just that constant sense that Trump is not, like, one of the things that Trump supporters like about him and say about him constantly, he's not a politician.
Sure.
Okay, fine. But he is now, and he has to behave a bit more like a politician than like a real estate mogul.
Yeah. The problem is the presidency has always and still does feel like a continuation of, a branch of Trump Incorporated.
Exactly. This is just Trump stakes.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Exactly what it feels like. And so, you and I can say as many times as we like, oh, Hamas are terrible people. They don't care about Gaza and civilians. Fine. So defeat Hamas militarily. That's fine. I strongly support Israel doing that. That doesn't mean you then clear everyone else off the land to turn it into some made up Riviera.
No, and you and I have our nuanced differences on what Israel's response should be. And they are nuanced rather than vast. But yeah, absolutely. Like, and worse than anything, right? Israel had an absolute military right to respond to October the 7th, okay?
Sure.
You and I have both always agreed on that. How they do it, how far that goes, that's where we've occasionally differed. But if you make this sound like that was part of the end process of getting a bloody real estate deal, how delegitimizing is that?
100% correct. And also, if you also make it sound like it is part of the extremist settler project,
absolutely,
that is also highly damaging to Israel, to Israelis, to diaspora Jews around the world, in my opinion.
Completely. I mean, you and I both constantly say, Jewish communities are not responsible for the actions of Israel. But that doesn't mean that they aren't being
responsible
or
being
threat.
Affected. Is a different
two
thing.
Different things. Exactly that. Exactly that.
But even forget the diaspora. Like, it is just, and this is why I mentioned some of the extremists who've been in and around the Netanyahu government as well. The Gaza war, I think you just said it, and I was a legitimate response to a terrorist atrocity against a terrorist organisation. I'm absolutely unequivocal about that. what it cannot then become, you know, and there is an element of don't start a war and then lose it. I understand that as well, you know, to Hamas, fine. But you cannot and should not, and I've always fundamentally objected to the kind of settler project and the settler narrative. And October the 7th did not start as that. The response to October the 7th did not start as that, and it must not end like that.
Absolutely.
I feel very strongly about that, as much as I feel strongly about dismantling Hamas and the legitimacy of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not going to end well for Israelis or Palestinians if the conversation about what needs to happen about the future of Gaza becomes a conversation about an American real estate project.
I mean, the fact you had to say that sentence,
right,
is utterly insane.
Completely.
And yeah. We'll bring it back from the reconstruction of Gaza to the reconstruction of British local government.
Well played, sir. Well played.
I mean, I wasn't going to, I'll lift the curtain a little
draw
bit.
Draw back the curtain.
Yeah. I wasn't going to do this subject today because I thought we had such big transatlantic issues to deal with that we should leave this for another day. But I started chatting off air about Angela Rayner's plans to overhaul local government. Frankly, I've never seen Emma so excited about almost anything I've ever said to her. So we are going to have to spend a few minutes doing this. Just explain the plans, Emma, as our resident local government nerd.
So basically, since the reorganisation in the 1970s that was incredibly difficult and kind of half done, there have been various layers of local government, tiers as they're known. I will come back to that. Where there are an awful lot of places with one layer of local government. So most cities, for example, have either one single city council, Birmingham City Council, Leeds City Council, Sheffield City Council, et cetera, et cetera. Or in London, because London's so big, there are 32 London boroughs, but they are a single council. There is the GLA that does other things, but there is quite a clear...
Oh, God, I've really set you off, haven't I? I'm
differentiation.
So sorry, listeners.
But there, in counties, what we've had for many, many years is a county council and district councils. And they do different things, but it's a quite arbitrary who does what and at what level. And it hasn't worked. It's made things a lot more complicated and a lot harder for local services to be developed at the level that's needed. Councils are a bit too big. District councils are a bit too small. Now, I once edited and helped to produce a pamphlet from a local government. In fact, two pamphlets on.
Just so you know, we've only got 3 minutes of the show left.
The first was called "As Tears Go By," but the second,
oh, Emma,
was called "Right Tear Right Now." I'm possibly prouder of that than almost any other of professional achievements.
Yeah.
But so what is being proposed?
I'm so pleased that listeners are getting an insight into what I have to part with.
Yeah, we don't just row about the Middle East. What is being proposed are smaller than county councils, but unitary authorities. So there's one decision-making body, which will have one directly elected mayor and then other councillors. So for example, there's one going to be called Greater Essex, which I think is based around three different councils.
Greater Essex,
Epping, Thurrock and Southend. And that makes a lot more sense as a kind of an economic area than the whole of Essex, which is incredibly big and incredibly diverse. And if you go to sort of Gray's in Thurrock, And then you go to Cheltenham and
Quite
you think
different.
very, very different places. So it's really, these make a lot more sense. So what is being proposed is that the county councils will go and these smaller areas will take over. As a result of that, some county councils that were going to have elections this year will not, because what is the point of electing somebody to a body that's going to be abolished in a year?
Those places that are not having elections are Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, Surrey, and Sussex. And as you might imagine, this has rather annoyed Reform and actually also the Liberal Democrats. And you can probably guess, oh, and Hampshire as well. So listing those places, you can imagine why those parties are particularly annoyed. Nigel Farage has decided it's all a giant conspiracy theory. Quote, he's used the word collusion. He said, I thought that only dictators cancelled elections, but what I see today is collusion to stave off the threat of reform on May the 1st. Sir Ed Davey has called it a disgraceful stitch up between Labour and the Conservatives, and accused the Conservative councils of running scared and denying voters a chance to kick them out of office in May. Now, obviously, the Lib Dems particularly care about local elections. The areas you can see, particularly Essex, were really ripe for reform. You know, that obviously Nigel Farage is allegedly the MP for Clacton, if you can find it on a map.
So I think the Lib Dems have a slightly better case here than Reform. Neither of them are right, but the Lib Dems at least didn't bang on and on and on and on when we ended up having
The EU
European
elections.
elections, EU elections, that these were completely pointless because we were leaving.
They actually did quite well in them.
They actually did extremely well in them. Whereas whatever reform was called at that time, and let's face it, it's all just the Nigel Farage party. When, really, really got cross about the waste of money of having an election to something we were leaving, this is the same thing.
Yeah, I mean,
It's not that there won't be political representation on these councils. They'll be there until they're abolished, and then there'll be new elections, which Reform are perfectly entitled to compete in and will probably do quite well in.
So they're saying basically those councillors currently elected will be in power for an extra year, basically,
That
in office.
happened for like when elections got delayed. That's happened in the past. I think there was elections that were delayed around foot and mouth.
There was COVID election.
COVID,
Didn't Sadiq Khan get an extra year or something? He rearranged things.
I think lots of local elections were postponed due to COVID. Yeah, because it wasn't a great idea for us all to go and stand in drafty church halls together.
Well, the drafty bit was probably the best bit about it.
Yeah. Fair, fair.
But no, I remember Sadiq Khan, nudging things along as what I know that's just because I'm in London. So. Look, I'd love to have a go at Angela Rayner about this. I can't get too worked up about democratically elected people staying in power for a bit of time longer, just while things get rearranged. I think if Labour had, this is me trying to be as fair as humanly possible. I think if Labour said we'll have elections in May 2025 and May 2026 in the same place, for the same set of people, you would definitely have seen stories about the waste of money and how much this was all costing XYZ local authority and central government. I think that would
Exactly.
be happening.
Absolutely. And it would be a waste of money. And I just think, and it would be more than just a waste of money, it'd be a waste of the councils who are incredibly stretched time and effort and energy when they could be, getting on with A, sorting out what the future is going to look like in terms of these new shaped local authorities, and B, getting on with delivering the services that they currently deliver.
Yeah, look, I don't have enough insight into it. Maybe I'm sure it'll be a topic we can come back to know if this is the right, oh, for goodness sake, to know if this is exactly the right outcome. One thing I
There's a
do know,
word that I want you to remember, subsidiarity.
you said you love that word,
I
and I've
do
been,
love that word. It's
it's
my
your,
favourite word.
I know, I'm aware. What the one comment I will make, having spent more time than any human should in Liberal Democrat meetings, is that there are very obviously too many layers of local government, and often what you end up with is lots of people sitting on a parish council, a district council, and like there are councils on three different places, but basically for the same area, but in three different bodies. That
Yeah,
that does
absolutely.
happen.
That happens a lot. There are lots of people who are district councillors and county councillors. And it's, there is a case that county councils are too far away from,
Right.
the areas that they, and too influenced by the bigger kind of bits of those areas and the richer bits of those areas too. A proper economic geography is how these things should be organized. I am sure, because I am a dork and a geek about all of this, that there will be things that I might critique about the eventual shape of this, of how this works out.
Oh, I can't wait for
But
that episode. Make sure you sign up to the Patreon to hear Emma doing that Emma's symposium on local government.
in terms of the overarching approach, the overarching point of doing this, it is long, long overdue.
Yeah, you may well be right. I think the other thing that it comes to me is a topic I've mentioned to you before, and something I feel very strongly about. Is you're saying, oh, maybe county councils are too big. There has to be a difference as well between councillors and MPs. You
Yes.
cannot have MPs as super councillors, and you can't therefore have councillors as
As mini MPs.
as mini MPs.
Yeah.
We have to find a way to get that balance right. I don't know if Angela Rayner has solved that problem, but it's a thing that we have to bear in mind when discussing this stuff.
Absolutely, 100%. And again, I come back to that. The point of economic geography is that you get a size of organize a size of authority where it is a reasonable assumption that whoever is elected to run it has walked down most of its streets, has at least visited most of its neighborhoods,
Nice.
understands the area that they represent.
Yeah.
And that is impossible with the whole of Essex or the whole of Kent.
They are indeed quite big areas. Well, thank you for coming to this, as I say, local government symposium part one with Emma Bunnell. Where else can people find you discussing this stuff, Emma?
You can find me on my Substack, which is called The Political Human. And I am on largely on Blue Sky as Emma Burnell.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Blue Sky and a bunch of other social media platforms, Threads, and so on. So I hope you'll join me there. We are, of course, not just here for the, well, we're here for our fun, but we'd also love you to support the show over at patreon.com/House of Comments podcast. We do extra episodes there, and the monthly subscriptions really do help us keep things going over here. So it would really mean a lot to us if you could do that and join us over there. That's patreon.com/House of Comments podcast. Because
And
you
what was
really
our
do,
last paid-only episode on Charlotte?
you do want to hear us doing the politics of the traitors. It was great fun. It was
It was so much fun.
did 20 minutes discussing the traitors and pretending we were talking about politics at the same time. Come join us over there, patreon.com/House of Comments podcast, and we'll see you all next week.